Weasel took off, and Arlo climbed away from the house up through the last steep section of garden above the buffers to where the crags began. Small birds flew away chattering through the overgrown clumps of lavender and lemongrass. The sun was hot on his back, and the crushed leaves scented the air. He stopped and shaded his eyes and watched Weasel, a white speck dwindling against the hugeness of the city. He hoped the old angel would not get distracted and forget the mission he had been entrusted with. The wave that had sluiced young Arlo's family away had spent most of its fury on the ragged isles. By the time it came to Maida, it was a lesser thing, and half exhausted. It still did damage, all the same, to the harbour and the shipping there. It would be the best part of a year before the city's salvagemen had ships and time to go and see if anything remained of Thursday's shipyard. When they brought Arlo back with them, people said that he had left his mine behind him on the island. It was no surprise, after his loss, and all those months he'd been out there alone. That must be why he wouldn't speak, and why, when the doctors put him in a comfortable room, he would not sleep in the bed like natural, goddess-fearing folk, but used bedding, chairs, and firewood to build himself a nest. He had gone lonely mad, they said, and could remember nothing of what had happened. But Arlo remembered all of it. And he had not been lonely. He had had the angels to comfort and to care for him. They had understood his grief, because they had so many griefs of their own. There was always some hatchling fallen from a ledge or some fine young bird taken by a hawk. They had come to the stranded boy with gentlings and cooings, with blankets of white feathers. They had taken him into their flock. And if he didn't speak at first on his return to the human world, it was not because he had forgotten how, only that he'd filled his mind with angel words, which were as likely to be small motions of his head or shuffled dance steps as sounds. It took him a while to dig down through that new language he'd learned and unearth his own. And if he seemed shy and afraid, it was only because the city was so strange to him, with the noise of all its people and their closeness and their roofs and walls and window frames and chimney stacks caging out the sky. He decided, as he settled back into his human life, that he would like to go and live at his family's townhouse, the funicular on Casas Elevado. But he was only 12, and the lawyers who controlled his affairs said it could not be. They leased the property to strangers, and Arlo went to live instead at Blaise's shipyards and be apprenticed there. Augusto Blaise had been the second finest shipwright in Maida before the wave came. And now that he was the first, he felt guilty. He had often gone to kneel at the Temple of the Sea and asked the goddess to wash Maida clean of his great rivals, Thursday and Sons. Now, shocked at how literally the Maya Bajo had interpreted his prayers, he felt himself responsible for young Arlo. His shipyards were outside the city, in a bay on the Costa Norte, reached by climbing up and down a steep road through the crater wall. That suited Arlo better than the harbour side. He lodged in Blaise's attic while the years went by, turning him into an able, likeable young man. He was big, but gentle with it, and always quiet, never a drinker and a racket-rouser and a chaser of girls like the other apprentices. But if old Blaise had hoped he'd bring some Thursday sparkle to the yard's designs, then he was disappointed. The boy's carpentry was good. He was obedient and hard-working. But that was all. He seemed uninterested in boats. His apprentice piece, a small schooner built from fragments of old Thursday vessels salvaged from the breakers' yards, showed skill, but no passion. The only things he made that hinted at Mad Dan Thursday's flair were the strange folded darts of scrap paper that Blaise sometimes found beneath his window or on the workroom floor. Unsettling things they were, like petals, leaves, wings, like nothing you could put a name to. And then there was the matter of the angels. Naturally, the beggar birds came clamouring around the yard when the workers stopped to eat their noonday pasties, and again in the evening when the smell of Senora Blaise's cooking wafted from the kitchen windows. But there was nothing natural about the way the big birds hung around young Thursday, never pestering him for scraps the way they did the other men, just watching him work. They talked to him sometimes with little becks and flutterings and squawks and fannings of their tails, and Arlo seemed to understand them. Sometimes he seemed to reply. When Weasel was out of sight, Arlo shook his memories aside and scrambled on up to a small opening in the cliff behind his house. A rusty iron grating covered it, but he had the key, and he opened it and went inside, into cool shadows and the smell of water. The builders of his funicular had dug a cistern into the crater wall to collect and store the water that was needed to move the house and counterweight up and down. It was a large, dark space, with only the glimmer of sunlight from the entrance to show the curved rock roof and the pillars reaching down into the deep pool that filled the heart of it. Rain that fell on the heights above came creeping down through fissures and faults, and although it was several weeks since any had fallen, Arlo could still hear water plopping and see the ripples spreading as drops fell into the pool. There was a smell of moss and dim growing things that did not love the light. "I'm going to be needing you," he said. "I think Vishniak is here." The echoes came back at him flatly out of the darkness. He looked across the water, his eyes adjusting to the lack of light. A ledge ran right around the pool, raised a few inches above the level of the water. Something moved on it, right at the far side where the shadows were deepest. Something lifted, rising to its feet. A small light came on, and then another, and then more, packed close together like a battery of glowing eyes, lighting reflections in the water. They shifted suddenly, and the faint noise of the thing and the echoes of it sounded across the water as it came padding along the ledge to meet its master. Tick, tick, tick. Chapter 9. A Leave of Absence. Maida was waking up as Fever walked thoughtfully back down the southern stair. The parasols that shaded the tables of the pavement cafes had opened up like daisies in the sunlight, and the bright air was full of the sounds of footsteps, voices, and the distant bangs and clangs and clatterings of the shipyards around the harbour. One of the voices belonged to Dr. Teal. It cut through Fever's thoughts as she was crossing the Rua Circulo, and she looked around to see the engineer standing beside the buffers of a big funicular hotel. A portable theodolite stood beside him on its spindly tripod like a gigantic pet insect. He seemed to have been measuring the angle of the hotel's rails. "Miss Crumb!" he called again, snapping shut the notebook in which he had been jotting down his findings. "Out for a morning stroll, I see. How are you liking Maida?" Fever looked away from his smiling face. She wanted to tell him what she had just witnessed up at Casas Elevado, but for some reason she could not bring herself to break the irrational promise she had made to Arlo Thursday. Luckily, Dr. Teal seemed not to notice her hesitation. "So," he said cheerfully, turning to wave at the hotel he had been studying. "What do you make of the funiculars, now that you've had a chance to see them for yourself? Impressive, aren't they?" "They are rather frivolous," said Fever. "And they must waste a great deal of water every time they empty their tanks." She disapproved of waste and frivolity, and she was surprised that Dr. Teal did not. "Oh, there's no shortage of water in Maida," the engineer replied. "The prevailing westerlies bring plenty of rain. Anyway, most of the ballast that the funiculars dump is not wasted. It finds its way through pipes and leaks into the reservoirs of the lower city. But you make a good point, Fever. A very good point. In London, of course, we shall use engines to pump the waste water from our funicular elevators back up, so that it may be used again and again. Breakfast?" "What?" Fever had been only half listening, and the sudden change of subject took her by surprise. "Shall we have some breakfast? You can tell me your other observations of Maida. All fascinating, I'm sure." Fever shook her head. She needed to be alone with her thoughts. "I have to get back to the theatre," she said, and started to turn away before he could protest. "The children will be wondering where I am." Mornings were the times when Fern and Ruin had their lessons. Fever had been shocked when she first took charge of the children to discover that they knew nothing of science and almost nothing of mathematics. At Miss Wernick's school in London, they had learned poems, read stories, and memorised a rather romantic version of history. But Fever didn't see how any of that would help to turn them into useful and rational adults. So, for an hour each day, she did her best to teach them fractions and long division, and the rudiments of calculus, and explain the laws of motion, and the recently rediscovered theory of evolution. They were not the most attentive pupils. Calculus and motion did not hold much attraction for them compared with the things that surrounded them on the Lyceum, where painted canvas could become a castle or a forest, and people could turn themselves into someone else. They had both decided already what their lives would be, and neither of them saw mathematics playing much of a part. Ruin was to be a painter, and Fern would be the finest actress of her generation. But they did not tell Fever that. They knew she would just have said that they were being irrational and made them study harder. That morning, though, she had as much trouble concentrating on the lessons as they did. Her thoughts kept drifting up to Casus Elevado. Sometimes she would forget Fern and Ruin altogether and start studying the angels that circled overhead, trying to puzzle out equations that would describe their aimless courses. She was starting to understand the curved shapes of the wings of the models that Arlo had shown her. The air flowing over the upper surface would be travelling farther, moving faster than that flowing underneath, which would mean that the pressure above the wing was lower than the pressure below. Would that pressure differential be enough to lift a whole machine into the air? Not on its own. No, of course not. But perhaps, if it was combined with the thrust provided by Saraband's engine... The children looked at one another, wondering what was distracting her, but not wanting to ask in case she set them back to work. It was a lovely sunny morning, and they didn't want to spoil it with sums. That afternoon they took a walk along the harbourside to see the ships that were tied up at the quays. Fever said it would be educational, and for once the children agreed. They ran from one berth to the next, calling out excitedly, "This one's huge! Oh, this one's even bigger!" There was a tiger-striped caravel from the Thousand Islands, a cog from the sea mark with its prow carved as a snarling dragon, and a six-masted oil tanker, just arrived from the Bight of Benin, bringing fuel for Bargetown's engines. There was also a long, lean, blood-red war galley, with a wicked-looking ram jutting from its prow, and a plaque on its stern castle announcing that it had been provided for Maida's defence by Senor J. Belkin. It impressed Fern and Ruin greatly to think that they had sat at dinner with a man so rich that he could buy whole warships. But Fever just kept looking past the ships, up toward the heights of the western wall. When Ruin asked her what was wrong, she said, "Nothing," and then pointed out a shabby funicular, just visible among the overgrown bushes at the top of its ragged garden. "That is Arlo Thursday's house. The mad lunatic Senora Belkin told us about. The man with the spider demon." "He does not have a spider demon," said Fever. "And I don't believe that he is half so mad as superstitious people like Ferzer Belkin like to claim. It is possible that his odd behaviour masks a rational, scientific mind, perhaps the only one in Maida. How lonely he must be, hidden in that peculiar house with his inventions." "That bird is following us," said Fern, who had not been listening. An angel perched on one leg on a nearby capstan head. It looked like a filthy feather duster on a pink stick. Fern said, "It was at the Lyceum while we were having lunch, and it has followed us all the way here."
"How can you tell it's the same one, silly?" Ruin asked. "They all look alike."
"It is probably just hoping that we have snacks for it," said Fever, and flapped her arms at the bird.
"Shoo! Be gone!"
The angel spread its white wings lazily and flapped away, but it did not go far, just up onto a tarpaulin-covered deckhouse near the bows of Jago Belkin's warship, where it watched Fever and the children as they walked on. Right out along the harbour mole they went, passing through the shadows of the bridge that spanned the harbour mouth and emerging into the sunlight again and the stiff salt breeze. Far out to westward, a scattering of islands bristled up like splinters on the ocean's rim. "They are called the Ragged Isles," said Fever, educationally, and she let the children take turns looking at them through AP's telescope, which she had brought along from the Lyceum for the purpose.
Not that they were very much to look at. Just stubs of black rock, with the white surf coming and going around their feet, and the white angel spatter shining on their crags, and the white of angel wings speckling the sky all around them.
They look like sad, weepy, lonely sorts of places, said Fern.
And Fever thought again of Arlo Thursday, who had been marooned there when he was no older than Ruin. The angel called Weasel perched on a buoy in the middle of the harbour. Others of his flock had perched there before him. They had left their droppings and a fish head. He ate it thoughtfully, watching Fever with his strange little blue bead eyes. It was the Lyceum's last night in Maida for a while. The next morning, the Persimmon Company was due to leave for the fiesta at Merriam. A.P. was determined to give a good performance, so that word would go on spreading while they were gone, and eager audiences would be waiting for them when they returned to Maida. But whatever it was that had set Fever daydreaming seemed only to get worse when the sun went down and the play started. She kept forgetting lighting cues, and often Ruin would peek into the periscope and see that the scenery he had worked so hard to paint was lost in shadow. If he had not hissed a reminder at her, she would have forgotten to turn on the spotlight for A.P.'s famous soliloquy in scene 4, the one that began, "'Tis but one small step for a man, yet for mankind it is a mighty leap.' And she missed the big blackout at the end of Act 1 completely, so the curtains had to be closed on a fully lit stage. The audience had not noticed, but A.P. had. "'What's wrong with Fever tonight?' he asked when Ruin went scrambling up to help with the big scene change in the interval. "'Is she in love or something?' "'Oh, no, A.P.,' said Ruin. Luckily, he was so hot and red from his time below that his blush did not show. He could sense that if Fern or Dimphna or Lilibet ever found out about his feelings for Fever Crumb, the teasing would be more than he could bear. "'Well, she's certainly daydreaming about something,' grumbled A.P. "'Remind her about the spotlight in Act 2, would you, Rue? I don't fancy delivering any more speeches in the dark.' When Ruin found his way back downstairs into Fever's domain, the cramped space felt as hot as a smithy. She was busy fiddling with some wiring, and she had forgotten to drink anything as usual. "'Are you all right?' he asked, handing her a mug of water. Fever stopped drinking just long enough to nod.
"'You seem a bit... I am perfectly well, thank you,' she said rather sharply.
Ruin felt hurt. Fever had never been exactly warm, but he had never seen her this distant, this distracted. Watching her gulp the water down, he remembered Dr. Teal and wondered, "'Was A.P. right? Was Fever in love with that London engineer?' "'Everybody is saying that the lighting is rubbish tonight,' he said spitefully, wanting suddenly to hurt her feelings. A.P. told me to say, be sure you don't forget his spotlight again. Things went a little better in the second half, and there were no more disasters. But as soon as the play was over and all the lights were shut down, Fever grabbed her coat and scrambled out of the barge.
Where are you going? Ruin asked.
I need some air. I won't be long. You can put Fern to bed if I'm not back in time, can't you, Rue? The boy did not reply. Fern had had to grow up fast after what had happened in London, but she was still only 7, and she liked Fever to be there to tuck her in. Ruin wondered what Fever had to do that could be more important than Fern's bedtime. He followed her to the offstage hatch and watched her walk away through the barge town crowds, wishing that he and Fern and the Lyceum were as interesting to her as whatever it was she had found in Maida. The city grew busy after dark. People stayed in their homes during the heat of afternoons and then came out in the cool of the night to stroll about the streets and meet their friends and eat in the open-air feasteries and tavernas. Fever found the harbourside streets crammed with people. Rowdy bands of sailors barged past her, bound for the nightclubs on the Rua Circulo. They called out saucily to Fever, telling her she was beautiful and asking her to come dancing with them, but she wasn't listening. She just strode along with her head down until she reached the southern stair and then turned up it and started to climb. On Rua Circulo, the clubs and restaurants leaked light and music into the night. She crossed it and kept on climbing, the crowds thinning as she went higher and higher. Casas Elevado was quieter than the streets below.
There were no angels roosting on the gateway of the Thursday house. She tugged on the bell pull, waited, tugged again. She waited some more. But the gate did not open. The house did not move. When she peered through the bars, she could just make it out, squatting up there among the toes of the crags, the amber oblong of a window coming and going as wind-blown foliage moved in front of it. Arlo Thursday was working late. She wondered what he was doing. Building more model gliders? Or something larger? She rang the bell again, willing him to open the gate and let her in. She would be gone tomorrow, and she had to talk to him again before she left. She needed to know more about his ideas. But his gate stayed stubbornly shut. She considered climbing the wall, but it was high, and Casas Elevado was not entirely deserted. One of the passers-by might mistake her for a burglar. The trees in the garden, black as puddled ink, rustled as the breeze blew on them, and she thought she heard something else rustle, too, a noise that seemed independent of the wind, as if some large creature was moving toward her through the shadows and the shrubs. A fox? A deer? Fever did not know enough about the fauna of Maida to guess. A spider demon? There were no such things, but there was something menacing about the noise, so stealthy and so purposeful. "Señor Thursday," she said hopefully. After a moment, the movement ceased. She had the odd feeling of being watched. It made her shiver. She realized how irrational she was being, standing here in the dark, imagining things. It had been irrational to come up here in the first place. What had she been hoping for? She stepped back from the gate and turned away. A tall, thin, scarecrow of a man was leaning against the railings on the far side of the street, his eyes glinting in the shadows under his hat brim. Something about the way he stood made Fever think he'd been there for a while. But when he saw her look at him, he turned away, pulled down his hat, and walked away. She shook herself. He had not been watching her. He had just been pausing there against the railings to admire the view down over all the moonlit rooftops to the harbour. That was all. She was letting her imagination play tricks on her. She walked quickly along the street to the southern stair, forcing herself not to look back at the Thursday house. Behind her, unheard in the dark of the garden, something softly ticked. The party was still going on when she reached the Lyceum. Fever climbed aboard the barge and went down to the children's cabin to check on them. Fern and Ruin were asleep, and she felt suddenly guilty that she had not been there to say good night to them. But doubtless someone else had done so. She climbed up onto the stage, thinking how tawdry and primitive the old barge looked. The ropes and cogs and mechanisms that lowered the backdrops were like things a caveman might have made. Even her electrical machines downstairs seemed crude and kludged together. It was hard to feel proud of what she had achieved here when she compared it with what Arlo Thursday was doing.
"Fever,"
called A.P., breaking free of a knot of friends and admirers to come and greet her.
"We don't often have the pleasure of your company at these little gatherings of ours. It's good to see you."
"A.P.," she said, coming straight to the point as always, "I do not want to leave Maida."
"Eh?"
The old actor was not used to people who came straight to the point. He blinked at her for a moment.
"But we are setting out for Merriam in the morning."
"I should like to stay here," said Fever. "Ruin and Fergus are quite capable of working the electrics now, and I would only be absent for a week or two. I will come back aboard when you return." AP looked concerned.
"Are you not happy with us, Fever?"
Fever hesitated. She knew it would upset him if she said yes, but she hated telling lies.
"Ah," said AP, starting to smile. "Say no more. There is a certain gentleman in Maida, a scientific gentleman, and you would like to stay here and help him with his work."
"How does he know?" Fever wondered. Then she realized that he was not talking about Arlo Thursday. AP had drunk several glasses of fine Maiden wine, and it made him forget that Fever hated being touched. He put his hands on her thin shoulders and smiled his most fatherly smile.
I am sure Dr. T will be very glad of such an able helper, as he struggles to comprehend the mysteries of Maida's moving houses, the actor went on. And if anyone has earned a holiday fever, it is you. After all the tireless work you've done for us these 2 years past, I was only thinking during the performance tonight. Miss Crumb is tired. She works too hard. She needs a break.
He was about to tell her that she must be careful as a young person alone in such a large and colourful city, but he could not find the right way to phrase it. Fever was more sensible than anyone he had ever met. He might be old, but inside he knew he had not really changed since he was 11 or 12. Fever, although she was just 16, was definitely a grown-up. It would be impertinent to lecture her. So he just said,
"We shall all miss you fearfully, of course. Miriam will not be the same without you. But yes, you have earned your leave of absence, and I'm sure Ruin and Fergus can manage the machines. You shall remain in Maida, my dear, while we console ourselves with the knowledge that we shall see you again on our return."
Chapter 10. The Blessing of the Summer Tides. "We shall all miss you fearfully," A.P. had said, and all the others had found time to say it, too, while they were busy packing the stage and scenery away and making the old barge ready to depart. But as Fever stood at the causeway head the next day to watch them go, she did not really think they would. They were all too excited about the trip to Meriam, and Fern and Ruin had the added excitement of 2 weeks without any lessons, for the rest of the company were all far too kind-hearted to make them spend half the morning learning things. It made her feel a little sad as she stood there waving after the departing barge. She was sure that she was more clever than anyone else on board, but she lacked something, something that even Fern and Ruin had, that made them all part of a family and not just individuals. Strangely, she felt less lonely standing there alone than she did when she was surrounded by all her friends. The Lyceum pulled away from her, with Max Froy in the driver's kiosk, steering it carefully along the zigzags of the causeway. A half-dozen other barges were making for Meriam, too, and the dust and smoke of their going hung over the sea and made it hard for Fever to make out the faces of the actors clustering on the sun deck to wave goodbye to her. She waved back, until she could no longer see anyone at all, then turned and picked up her bag and walked back through the shadow of Maida's gate forts into the city. Whatever sadness she had felt at being left behind soon vanished. It felt good and grown up to be alone, with no one to answer to but herself. It was a feeling she had had briefly once before, when she first left God's Hawk's Head to go and work for Kit Solent in London. That had not worked out very well. She had ended up being chased through the city by a crazed mob. But she was older and more rational now, and Maida was not London. She looked forward to living here alone. She had some money in the leather pouch on her belt. AP had always been scrupulous about sharing out the Lyceum's profits, and although Fever's share was only small, she seldom spent it on anything. So she had amassed quite a lot in 2 years. She found her way to a respectable hotel that A.P. had told her of on the Rua Badrugan and took a room. It was a narrow room, high up in the old building, with a window that looked out on nothing but roof tiles and chimney pots. But it was 10 times as large as her cabin on the Lyceum, and for the next few days, at least, it was all hers. She arranged her things neatly in the wardrobe and along the bedside shelf, counted what was left of her cash, and went out into the city. She planned to find Dr. Teal and let him know that she had not left for Meriam with the others. But first she would climb to Casas Elevado and try again to speak with Arlo Thursday. Surely, when he saw how persistent she was being, he would open his gate to her. Despite the afternoon heat, the streets below Rua Badrugan were busy, and when Fever reached the harbour side, she found out why. A religious procession was making its way across the lock gates, amid much tooting of shawms and battering of driftwood glockenspiels. Irritated, Fever tried to shove her way through the crowds of Maidens who had stopped to watch.
but the crowds were too dense, and anyway, she needed to cross the lock gates herself. It would add an hour to her walk if she avoided them by going right around the harbour. So she stopped to watch as the priests and priestesses marched slowly toward her, some holding up big blue windsock banners shaped like winged fish, others helping to support a sort of litter, on which a gaudy statue of the Maya Bajo perched. Every now and again, they would all stop while someone declaimed a prayer, and handfuls of petals and coins were scattered into the harbour. "Señorita Crum," said a voice in Fever's ear, and she looked around into Fetzer Belkin's dizzying smile. "You have come to see our festival." "I'm just waiting to cross the harbour," said Fever.
"Then wait with us," said Fetzer, and she took Fever's arm and guided her to a clear place at the front of the crowd, where Fat Shargo was waiting with a servant holding up a parasol to shade him, and two more carrying trays of iced drinks. Fetzer passed a glass to Fever, and Fat Shargo said,
"A pleasure to see you, Miss Crum. I thought your barge had pulled out this morning. Nothing amiss, I hope."
"The Lyceum has gone," said Fever, "but I decided to stay."
Fat Shargo nodded understandingly.
"I hear there is another member of your guild in Maida. No doubt you will be working with him."
"Not exactly."
Condensation from the outside of the glass trickled coolly between Fever's fingers. The drink was fruit juice, iced and spiced, and as she sipped it, she felt a thrill of pleasure that these rich and kindly people should want her company.
"You must think us very primitive to have turned out to watch such a silly display," Fat Shargo said, nodding toward the priests who had stopped to pray again.
"It is the blessing of the summer tides," said his wife.
"Of course, we don't believe it," Fat Shargo went on. "We know the tides would still rise and fall, and the fish would still swim into Maiden nets without all this pretty flummery. But it is a ritual, a ceremony, a tradition that links us with our ancestors and our city's past. I hope you understand."
"I have come to watch the procession every year since I was a little girl," said Fetzer, who looked as excited as a little girl still, her eyes shining and a laugh bubbling behind every word. "Do you see the statue on the litter there? That is the holy likeness of the Mai, which is taken out of its tank at the Temple of the Sea for just this one day out of all the year. It was discovered in the long, long ago, washed up on the shore after a storm."
"There are educated men who claim it's not the Mai Bajo at all, but a likeness of some other goddess who used to be worshipped in these parts," said Fat Shargo.
"Well, educated men do not know everything," retorted Fetzer, who seemed to take the old religion more seriously than her husband did.
She shaded her eyes against the sunlight to watch as the procession reached the end of the lock gates and stepped down onto the harbour side. Pretty young acolytes came hurrying through the crowd with fishing nets, into which people dropped fish-shaped maiden coins. A dropped orange rolled into the dust underfoot, until a small, tow-haired boy ran out of the crowd and picked it up.
"There was a time," said Fetzer Belkin, "when the Maya Bajo used to appear to people. She would rise up out of the depths to speak with shipwrecked sailors and drowning fishermen. She would save them and carry them to the shore, and she gave them revelations, messages that let us know how we could best please her. I used to love those stories when I was little. I used to hope that I might see her for myself one day, but it doesn't happen nowadays. I wonder why."
"Because people are less gullible than they used to be," said Fat Shargo. "I bet Orca Maw would love a good revelation. Look at her. She knows she's turning into a mere party decoration. She'd love to announce some new appearance by the Maya Bajo to strengthen people's faith and restore her own power. But she knows that hardly anybody would believe it."
The priestess passed them, with all the tentacles of her squid hat trailing in the wind. She did look a little self-conscious, thought Fever. Perhaps Fat Shargo was right. Perhaps even Orca Maw knew that her religion was losing its meaning.
"So, what has kept you in Maida?"
Fat Shargo asked, raising his voice above the jingle of tambourines as the statue on its litter passed them.
"Would it be Young Thursday, by any chance?"
Fever looked at him in surprise. How did he know that she had been planning to see Arlo Thursday?
Thatcher laughed and touched Fever lightly on the wrist.
There is nothing that happens in Maida that Jargo doesn't find out about. He's incorrigibly nosy.
I'm a businessman, her husband protested. I keep my ear to the ground, that's all. And from the way Miss Crum asked after Thursday the other evening, I could tell he interested her.
He looked serious for a moment, leaning closer to Fever.
Be careful, my dear. What I said about Arlo Thursday was quite true. He really is mad.
I do not think so, said Fever. It unsettled her that Fat Jargo knew her business, but she was not sure why. And why did she feel this sudden need to defend Arlo?
He is certainly eccentric, but he seemed perfectly rational to me.
You've actually spoken with him, then?
Fat Jargo's forehead crinkled like a Roman blind as he raised both eyebrows.
I didn't think he saw anyone nowadays.
Only his angels, said Thirza
softly, watching the statue go by. There was a sadness in her eyes, and Fever wondered if it was because of the goddess or because of Arlo Thursday.
Thirza used to have a thing for young Thursday, said her husband, turning jocular again.
Oh, Jargo, his wife laughed. Don't be silly. He worked for a while at my father's shipyard, that is all. We were friends.
Childhood sweethearts?
Not at all. Anyway, imagine if I'd married him, I would be called Thirza Thursday. Have you ever heard such a silly name, Fever?
If you'd married Thursday, said her husband, your silly name would be the least of your worries. It's true that I may not be as young and good-looking as him. It's true that I haven't seen my toes for 30 years, and I don't expect ever to see them again. But at least I can provide for you.
Of course you can, said Thirza, reaching across Fever to take his hand.
Nevertheless, said Fat Jargo, I would ask you, as a friend, not to call on Arlo Thursday any more. Who knows what he gets up to in that old house? I would fear for your safety if you went there again.
Fever felt herself bristle.
What gave Fat Jargo the right to tell her what she should do and who she should see? He claimed to be rational, but he was as blinded as the rest of Maida by those foolish stories about the Thursday family. He clearly meant his warning kindly, though, so she thanked him as politely as she could. But still, she wondered how he had known that she had been calling on Arlo.
The procession had passed. The crowd of onlookers started to break up, some following the statue of the Mai Abajo back toward her temple, others drifting away along the harbourside or across the lock gates. The Belkins were keen that Fever should go and have lunch with them, but she said no. The afternoon was wearing on, and she had the long climb to Casas Elevado ahead of her. She agreed to visit them at their villa the next day, then set out across the lock gates alone.
Chapter 11. Aeroplane. At the Thursday house, the gate was still locked, and there were no angels waiting. Fever tugged at the rusty bell pull again without much hope, and wondered what else she could do with the remainder of the afternoon. But to her surprise, the gate swung open, and as she stepped through it, she heard the house rumbling down to meet her. "Miss Crum," said Arlo Thursday, opening the front door to her, as the building came to rest against its buffers. "I thought you had gone away." "The Lyceum is gone. I decided to stay."
"Oh."
"I've been thinking about what you told me," she said, "about flight."
"That can be dangerous," he told her.
He was looking past her, scanning the garden, as if wanting to make sure that no one else had slipped in with her. "Even thinking about flight can be dangerous." They stood there on the veranda, watching each other. The wind blew in through the open front door and stirred the litter that lay on the floor of the hallway. Angel feathers and delicate curls of wood that looked like bits of pasta and rustled like paper as they rolled across the floorboards.
"You shouldn't have stayed," Arlo Thursday said. Then he shrugged. "You'd better come in."
He led her through the shady, cluttered house to its kitchen,
and started making coffee before she found the nerve to tell him that she really only drank boiled water. The smell from the coffee pot filled the large, low-ceilinged room, and to Fever, whose scriven senses lent every scent a colour, it smelled as golden as the sunlight that washed in through the dirty windows when Arlo raised the blinds. "Once a week I bring the house down here, and a delivery boy drops off the stuff I need and picks up payment," he said. "I've got some money left out of what Edgar paid me for designing his flyer. Not much, but enough for bread and cheese and coffee. That's all I need." Fever gave a sceptical sniff. Bread and cheese and coffee hardly constituted a balanced diet, and she could also think of several other things that Arlo Thursday needed, such as some soap and a broom and a feather duster. The faint blue odour of his unwashed body reached her clear across the kitchen and mingled unattractively with a scent of days-old food mouldering on the plates piled up on the table. Books and papers were heaped up there too, and splashes of birdlime crusted on shelves and chairbacks suggested that the angels were allowed indoors. The place offended Fever's sense of order, as well as her sense of smell, but she did her best to ignore it and concentrate on the model flying machines that swayed above her, hanging on their barely visible threads from the kitchen ceiling. He handed her a tin cup filled with coffee. She looked down at it and saw her reflection gawping up at her from its umber surface. It was definitely too late now to tell him that she didn't approve of coffee, and she wondered what she was going to do with the stuff. "I've got something to show you," said Arlo Thursday. "Come on." They went back through the house, past an open doorway that gave Fever an unattractive glimpse of Arlo's unmade bed and a bedroom strewn with cast-off clothes. He led her to another door, around which the floor was heaped with more of those curls of pale wood she'd noticed earlier. Sawdust lay thickly there, and mice had left wandering trails through the drifts, like the footprints of lost explorers in a desert, vanishing in the draught as Arlo swung the door open. He stood back to let her go past him into a big, curtained space, which she supposed had once been the old funicular's dining room. There was rich paper on the walls, though it was old and peeling, and the mice had nibbled it. There was an expensive-looking antique dining table that seemed to have been turned into a workbench, its surface completely hidden beneath heaps of tools and piles of papers. Fever barely noticed it. There was only one other thing in the room, but it occupied her whole attention.
It was a flying machine.
It was only half finished, the fine, blonde, wooden bones of its wings and body not yet covered with paper. But already it had the grace that Fever had recognised in the models. There was a sense of imminence about it, of some flying thing at rest, readying itself to spring into the air. It looked caged, filling the room, the tips of those skeleton wings touching the walls. She looked back at Arlo. He was watching her. She could see the machine mirrored in his eyes. "It is based on the designs I made for Edgar Saraband," he said. "But I've made some improvements." She circled the machine, ducking under the broad wings, running her fingers over the smooth, planed struts. Again she noticed the shape of the wings in cross-section, that rounded leading edge and the unmatching curves of the top and bottom surfaces. Still watching her, Arlo said suddenly, "There's a bit of ancient math, the Navier-Stokes equations.
They describe the movement of objects in water," said Fever, startled,
for she had never imagined that anyone outside the engineers would know of the equations. They had been one of the Order's treasures, unearthed in an old library.
"The equations work for air, too," said Arlo, "for any fluid medium. My grandfather was a shipbuilder. He used them to work out the best shape for oars and keels and rudders. That's what made me think of applying them to wings. Once you know how the air flows round a wing, you can shape it to provide more lift."
Fever looked at him out of his web of struts and cables. This strange young man had made a leap of reasoning worthy of an engineer. She touched the propeller, mounted in the heart of the structure, pointing backward. Still crude, waiting to be planed and sanded, but already roughly shaped and moving easily on its axle. She said, "How is it to be powered?" Arlo pointed at something among the debris on the table. A dark metal thing like a warrior's helmet, hinged open to expose crude pistons. She went closer. It was an engine.
a Saraband Mark I aero engine, according to the brass plate on its side. Edgar sent that to me just before he died. He sent instructions on how it should be mounted, how it's linked to the propeller. I'll launch from the cliff top. The engine will thrust me forward while the wings provide lift.
A cliff top? Asked Fever. How will you even get your machine out of the house?
In sections. It comes to pieces, and it is quite light. I have a place in mind where I can test it.
I could help you, she said.
It's dangerous.
I don't care.
You would if you understood. In his last letters to me, Edgar was frightened. And then he was killed. His machine crashed.
An accident?
We'll be more careful. Not an accident, I'm sure of it. The machine should have flown. I read reports, it climbed, but then it fell. Someone must have tampered with it. Saraband was murdered.
By whom?
There was a man called Lothar Vishniak. Edgar wrote to me about him. A stranger who hung around his workshop. Edgar said at first what a good fellow he was. But later, I think he was afraid. I think that's why he sent the spare engine to me, so that I could continue his work if he was murdered.
Fever saw very clearly in her mind's eye that tall man who had stood watching her the previous night while she had loitered at Arlo's gate. Then she shook her head. This was just paranoia. Saraband had been involved in dangerous research, so it was natural that he would have been apprehensive. There was no rational reason to think that he'd been murdered. She came right around the machine and back to where Arlo stood, waiting by the door.
Senor Thursday.
Arlo?
Arlo, I could help you. You needn't do all this work alone. There is another engineer in Maida. Dr. Teal. I'm sure that if I told him about you, he could put you in touch with our guild in London.
It was the wrong thing to say. Those blinds came down again behind Thursday's eyes.
I knew you were working for someone, he said angrily.
I'm not working for anyone.
He let out a laugh so bitter that it barely sounded like a laugh at all.
Oh, Fever Crumb, he said. I almost believed you the first time you told me that.
But you're just another spy, aren't you?
That's why you're still here, even though your theatre's gone. You're working for this Londoner, and he sent you to me because he thought I'd be more likely to talk to a pretty girl than an ugly old engineer.
That isn't true.
Well, you can tell your London engineer that I'm not interested.
But he'd want to help, I'm sure, said Fever, flustered by his sudden show of emotion.
All scientific progress is of interest to the engineers. They will want to hear all about your discoveries. Dr. Collihole will be fascinated to see your machines and to share his own designs with you. That is the way of true scientists, isn't it? To share our work, so that our colleagues can point out the flaws in our theories and build upon our discoveries.
Get out! Shouted Arlo Thursday. He snatched a wrench from the table, knocking other tools to the floor. Fever backed away, alarmed by the anger in his eyes. Maybe Dr. Teal and Fats Iago had been right about him after all. Maybe, for all his brilliance, he was crazy. She hurried to the door and out into the hallway.
Out!
Shouted Thursday behind her. She heard his footsteps and thought he was coming after her. But when she looked back, she saw he had turned the other way, into a small room packed with levers, dials and gauges. She felt the house lurch and heard water splashing beneath the floor as the tanks emptied. The tanks of the counterweight must already have been filled, for by the time she opened the front door, the building was in motion, rising slowly away from its buffers. Fever hesitated, then jumped from the moving veranda, landing awkwardly in the long grass beside the track and falling over. As she went shakily back through the overgrown garden, she sensed something moving through the bushes by the path and thought for a moment that she heard a noise, a stern ticking like an angry grandfather clock. But when she stopped to listen, the noise stopped too, and she dismissed it. She went to the gate, and it opened to let her out, and closed again behind her with a clang that sounded final this time.
Arlo Thursday is deranged,
she told herself, as she stood in his gateway slowly calming down. I was wrong to seek him out. But just because he had been unreasonable did not mean that she should abandon reason too. She recited perfect numbers to herself until she felt calmer, then thought about Arlo and his strange past. She had been unfair to him, she decided.
Unlike her, he had never had the benefit of an upbringing among engineers. Indeed, he'd been partly brought up by birds. Clearly, it had left him with a deep mistrust of other people. That must be why he lived all alone, with only that gaggle of angels for company. That must be why his only friendship had been conducted by letter, with a man he had never even met. He was frightened of people. That was why he imagined enemies everywhere and fancied that Saraban's death must have been murder. He needed help. He needed to be protected from his own irrational fears. He might not know it, but he needed Fever Crumb. She straightened her clothes, smoothed back her hair, and set off. Whether Arlo wished her to or not, she had a duty to take the news of his discoveries to Dr. Teal. She was so busy with her own thoughts that she did not notice the tall, shabby man who leaned against the railings on the far side of Casas Elevado and watched her go. Chapter 12. The Fountain. Jonathan Hazel, London's representative in Maida, was a small man, a quiet man, and in many ways a dull one. He had moved to the city in his youth with vague ideas of romance and adventure. But he wasn't cut out for those things, and in his rambling house on the Rua Penhasco, he lived alone, leading the same small, quiet, dull life that he might have lived in London. Not that he was unhappy. He enjoyed his daily routine, visiting the Harbourside Exchange each morning to trade and drink coffee with the other merchants, walking briskly home in the middle afternoon to sit in his courtyard garden. On days when the sea was calm, he sometimes took his little boat out fishing in the shallow waters between Maida and the mainland. And he enjoyed his role as London's official representative in Maida, which meant that visiting London traders would seek him out, bringing news from home. At least, he had enjoyed it until Dr. Teal arrived. Dr. Teal, who had turned up very late 2 nights before, striding in his muddy boots across Jonathan Hazel's polished floors and announcing that he would be staying, saying breezily that he meant to make the house his base of operations, whatever that might mean, for the foreseeable future, however long that was, insisting that Jonathan Hazel send a message off to London by expensive express courier with no mention made of compensation. Jonathan Hazel had half a mind to throw the impertinent fellow out. But Jonathan Hazel was not the sort of man who threw people out of places. And, angry though he was, he realised that it might not be a good idea to upset this envoy from London, who carried papers signed by the chief engineer and by London's new ruler, the barbarian warlord Quercus. So, eager to show how loyal he was to the new regime, he had let Dr. Teal take over his lovely, comfortable bedroom up at the top of the house and had removed himself to the guest room. Since he had never had any guests, he had not realised how lumpy and uncomfortable the guest room bed was until he slept in it himself, or failed to sleep. For 2 nights now, he had lain awake, listening to the grumble of nearby funiculars going up and down the crater walls. He had been too tired and upset to go to the exchange that morning. He had decided to stay at home and catch up on his sleep and let his Maiden clerks handle business. But no sooner had he dropped off for his afternoon nap than he was woken by a jangling at the doorbell. He waited for the servants to answer it. But of course, at this hour the servants were all out. So he got out of the horrible bed and wrestled his dressing gown on and went stalking downstairs, past the breakfast room littered with Dr. Teal's papers, to the door. A girl of some sort stood on the step. A tall girl, in an odd white coat, with severe hair. Jonathan Hazel supposed that was the fashion among girls nowadays. She had strange eyes. Indeed, she had a strange sort of face altogether. She reminded him faintly of the Scriven, who had ruled London when he was young. Some old, submissive instinct kicked in and stopped him from telling her to go away. "I am Fever Crumb. I am here to see Dr. Teal," she said primly. Well, of course she was. Jonathan Hazel drew himself up to his full height, though it didn't do him much good, as it only brought his nose to the level of Fever Crumb's sternum. He said, "Well, he isn't."
isn't here, I mean, to see you. He's out. He's gone out to make drawings, for some reason.
Do you know when he'll be back?
I am not Dr. Teal's social secretary, said Jonathan Hazel sharply.
But he wasn't much good at being sharp with people. This girl was very pretty, really, despite her scrivenish looks, and she seemed so disappointed to find Teal gone that he at once felt guilty for speaking in that hasty way. He remembered something that the engineer had said at breakfast, while he sat reading Jonathan Hazel's newspaper and eating rather a lot of Jonathan Hazel's marmalade.
"I think he told me that he was going up to the Plaza del Sol," he mumbled. "You will probably be able to find him there. The second stairway on your left at the end of the street will take you to it."
"Thank you," said Fevercrumb, and walked away along the street through the sunlight and the shadows of the lemon trees, while Jonathan Hazel stood on his front doorstep and watched her go, wondering why such an attractive young person would be seeking out the bumptious Dr. Teal. The engineer was sitting cross-legged on the wall of a fountain in the corner of the Plaza del Sol. There was a statue in the middle of the fountain that showed the Maya Baggio in her sky goddess aspect, surrounded by leaping stone flying fish and fat stone rain clouds. Water from holes in the bases of the clouds fell prettily into the fountain all around the goddess, and sometimes, when the warm breeze gusted, it fell on Dr. Teal as well. The engineer had a large notebook open on his lap, and he was making a careful drawing in it of a nearby funicular, a house much larger than Arlo Thursday's, with six sets of rails stretching up the landscaped crater wall behind it. The little crowd of Maiden children who had gathered to watch him work were as quiet as he, absorbed in the strange foreigner and the picture he was making. But they drew aside when Fever came striding up. Dr. Teal left off his drawing, snapped his notebook shut, and looked up at her, beaming.
"Miss Crumb, I thought you'd gone south with your theatre."
Fever couldn't be bothered to explain again, so she just shook her head. "I have spoken with Arlo Thursday," she said.
"Really? And what did you make of him?"
Fever sat down beside him. The ledge beside the fountain was damp, brushed by the drifting spray. She said, "He is very peculiar, unkempt and agitated, not at all like an engineer. Yet I think he has a great deal of knowledge. Have you heard of Edgar Saraband?"
"Yes, a Thelonian nobleman who killed himself trying to fly some sort of contraption off the cliffs there a few months back.
I believe Saraband's flying machine was 9/10 Arlo's invention. Saraband built the engine, but Arlo designed the wings and body, and he has intriguing ideas about..." She cut herself short. She was babbling. "Dr. Teal, I think he has unlocked the secret of flight." She repeated, as quickly as she could, the things that Arlo Thursday had told her. When she had finished, Dr. Teal rubbed his chin and said, "So, the Thursday boy is an inventor."
"Can the guild help him?" asked Fever. "He is afraid. He mentioned a man named Vishniak."
Dr. Teal shrugged.
"The name means nothing to me. Who is he?"
"Arlo thinks he murdered Edgar Saraband." Dr. Teal looked sharply at her, and then started to laugh.
"Murdered? Miss Crumb, your time aboard the theatre has left you with a vivid imagination."
Fever felt herself blush at the insult, but pressed on.
"I know it sounds irrational, but there was a man hanging around outside Arlo's house yesterday evening."
"What manner of man?"
"Tall, shabby, a hat like yours, and a long coat. Rather a long face, unshaven."
Dr. Teal looked thoughtful.
"That sounds like Flynn. I didn't know he had dragged himself to Maida."
"You know him?"
"I've met him once or twice in my travels.
Maida's Flynn.
He's a shady, small-time technomancer, out of ideas and not above stealing them from better men."
"Do you think he might have killed Edgar Saraband?"
"No, no. Flynn's shifty, but he's not the murdering type. Anyway, poor Saraband didn't need any help killing himself. That fool engine of his exploded. He was blown to bits."
"So the fault was with the engine, not with Arlo's machine," said Fever eagerly. "If we could only find him somewhere he could work in peace, and help him to make a better engine."
"You think his invention would be in London's interests?" asked Dr. Teal.
"Of course it would. It would be in everybody's interests. If we could fly like the ancients did, think of the possibilities for trade, for exploration. Above all, it will put an end to this mad notion of setting London moving. Why would a city need to move if there were flying machines that could move faster and more safely?